Good morning. Now, who in this room, perhaps we could have a show of hands, would like to be chief executive of the Football Association in England? How many? First woman, that's good news. A guy here, Mr. Dean has kept his hand down, very noticeable. Anyway, it's very interesting for someone like me to see the answer to that question. Why would anybody? At least, the job has had at least six occupants in the past 14 years, and that's not counting myself, who filled in on two or three significant periods. Several of those who did fill the job will tell you they never had real power to make a difference. Some of them moan endlessly about the bullying Premier League. But the reality, the fact, is that England have not won the World Cup for a mere 49 years, and fewer English-born players play in our top division every Saturday. And that's before you're reminded of the fact that I grew to know very, very much that the public, when they're not blaming the government or the royal family for just about everything, blame the FA. But some of us never give up hope. And that's probably because we're lucky enough to know what we believe is the very good work, a lot of it unknown and unseen by the public, that is done by the FA, home and abroad, week in, week out. And so when the FA has a new, yes, yet another chief executive, we welcome that person and we hope very much that they are successful and they get the success that they deserve. And here we have someone who has had considerable experience with the likes of Cadbury Schweppes, with the likes of Mars, with the likes of Walkers, with the likes of United Biscuits, as well as winning a number of awards in business and industry, and being a qualified football coach, and an ex-Leicester City director. And, dare I say it, as I live in the West Midlands, also he is a season ticket holder of Wolverhampton Wanderers. What can we expect from the latest chief executive of the Football Association? Please welcome Martin Glenn.
Thank you very much. Hi, good morning.
The first bit of bad news is we've both got grey suits on, which encourages the stereotype. But anyway, I've got to start with the latest news. England are into the finals of Euro 2016, and there's a bloke called Rooney, whose first game I remember as if it was yesterday, and he scored a record number of goals. I mean, how do you feel this morning?
Feel good. Feel a little bit tired. It was a late night last night, an early start this morning, but we qualified, don't forget, on Saturday.
Yeah.
With the win at San Marino, but the I think the great thing we've done is we've qualified with real aplomb. You know, we've won all of our eight games, and you can only play the teams that you're up against. There's been some criticism, you know, what can you do about it, that the team wasn't the strongest, but there's some decent teams in there. Switzerland are a decent team. We've beaten them twice with a young squad, and I think that that's probably the key difference. So no one in the FA is sort of, you know, naive about the fact that that we're playing the most difficult game in the world, the most competitive game in the world, football. So, you know, you're up against tough competition, but we've done it with a young squad, I think, playing with some flair and playing, most importantly, better than we did emerging from the World Cup in Brazil.
And as far as Wayne Rooney is concerned, do you, within the FA these days, are you conscious of being there in the generation of a player who is a record goal scorer ever for his country and will be a legend for his country?
Well, I think it's great to have, but it's a team game. And I think the first one to accept that and embrace that is Wayne. There's a great little clip on the FA website, which I think has been well distributed around all the media about Wayne's speech last night in the changing room. It's worth seeing. It's only about a minute and a half. You get a measure of the man there. He's very gracious. He receives the applause of his teammates. He gets a shirt from Roy Hodgson saying 50 on the back, and makes a very good speech about how he's personally very proud, but it doesn't mean that much unless England do well. You should see it. It's very good.
Why though? I mean, this is the big question. When they get to France next year, is there any logical reason for having any confidence that England will do any better than their customary arrival in the quarterfinals? And the cynics say the departure on, you know, England will play Germany and Germany will win on penalties.
It's been Portugal, hasn't it, the last couple of times?
Yeah, it has been Portugal.
Yeah, of course there's a logical reason and there's emotional reasons. If you step back, what are the reasons to be more confident this time? I think the managers had sort of a difficult hand of cards, I think particularly within the World Cup situation where it was quite an ageing squad. There hadn't been the rebuilding that was needed. So you start with the fact that there's been a lot of new blood coming in. I think the average age is under 25. So it's different. So, you know, if it were exactly the same, you'd say what would be the reasons for different results? Probably not much. But the team's different. The mood of the team's different. There's a lot of learning. You know, Roy Hodgson is a good manager with good experience. He has learnt a lot from his experience of the first, you know, two tournaments. And you know, we now have a setup at St George's Park where we're much more purposeful about the kind of backup support that we give our elite teams. And I think you might talk about women's football later on, but let me give you an example. Our women's team had a very successful World Cup, as you all know. We finished third. We beat Germany for the first time. We got to the semi-finals. We didn't go there with the best team. So technically, I think the women's team in England is still some years behind Germany and France, partly because we started playing women's football later. The FA had banned women's football for longer than our continental counterparts and banned mixed football. So we start from a little bit backwards. But what worked brilliantly in that tournament was tournament management. Mm. And Mark Sampson's a very good manager, but he went out with two assistant managers, three video analysts, nutritionists, sports medical scientists, sports psychologists, a backup team. It's tournament resilience that's also part of what can be taught. So it's not just, yeah, look at Germany. Why have they done so well over the years? They've done well in tournaments with not very good teams, but they overperform in the tournaments. And I think that's one of our opportunities.
Oh, so some of the Blazers who spent their time saying that the team behind the team was far too big in a previous generation, perhaps, they've been quietened, have they?
Yeah. Well, I don't. I've not had anyone say that to me. I mean, yeah. To me, it's obvious.
Well, you have now.
Well, are you a Blazer, David?
I hope not.
No, yeah. I mean, I think what we've tried to do, and if, for those of you who aren't aware of it, we have effectively a centre of excellence in the Midlands called St George's Park, where the idea is that we co-locate all of the managers of all of our teams, the senior men's team all the way through down to under 16s and the senior women's team. And we're trying to apply the best practice achieved in other sports into football. So we've got a guy called Dave Redding, who was an assistant to Clive Woodward in the 2003 Rugby World Cup. We've hired a guy called Chris Earle, who's in charge of our education system, because we want to really improve the quality of coach education. So not being afraid to learn from other elite sports is part of what the difference is. And frankly, if someone says, what's the value of a backroom staff? There's lots of good reason to demonstrate what the value is, and we're not going to take risks on it anymore. We'll send all of our teams as best prepared as we can into these tournaments.
To be fair to Socrex, they had a very good session here on day one, on Monday, with Andrew Strauss from cricket, yep, and Darren Lehman, the Australian coach, and Ian Ritchie from rugby football, yep, and the guy who's in charge of performance for UK sport. And that was primarily about lessons, yep, for football from other sports. And they believed there were lessons from those other. And Clive Woodward, who you mentioned as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've had the dilemma, quite interestingly, Martin, that I remember well, of do you give a contract to the existing coach before you get to France, so that he has that security going beyond the tournament, and you've chosen not to, which is not what the FA has done in the past.
Well, I think it's been made to be probably a bit more of an issue than it is, and Roy is very comfortable with the situation. He, more than anybody, knows it's a results game. So I think what we wanted to avoid was the probably slightly unsavoury position we had with Fabio Capello at the end of the World Cup, where, you know, it clearly didn't work for people. But it's a results game. And, you know, the issue of contract is not a moot issue right now. Everything we want to do with Roy and the senior team is find out what are the best ways of making Roy successful, because a successful England team in the Euros is going to kick on and do great things in the World Cup. So I guess my philosophy is you pay for results and you create a tension where results have to happen, but at the same time want to give, you know, confidence and support to the people involved. So if it is a change in the FA, I think most people would see it as a welcome change, and I think it's the right one.
But you know how the English media writes it up. They write it up. It's win or bust, don't they?
Well, they can write what they will. Myself and Roy have got a very good relationship. I think he's by far and away the best coach we could have for England. His international experience is huge. He's a learner. He looks, he listens. So, you know, our ambition is the same one, which is let's make England as successful as we can. And we've got this big ambition to win the World Cup in 2022. I love long-term ambitions, but in the long term, we're all dead. So we've got three tournaments since till then. We've got the Euros, we've got the World Cup in Russia, which I think we'll qualify for, and we've got the Euros again, which are going to be held across Europe, but with the semis and the finals at Wembley in 2020. Why not? Why not go with ambition? Unless you have ambition, you know, you rarely achieve. So the right ambition with then the right, you know, the right backup to make that ambition happen is what we're about.
Why has the chief executive of the FA in England been such an insecure job? And why do people abroad talk about the revolving door of FA leadership?
Well, I suspect it's because there's been a lot of change, and yes, as you said in your preamble. So, you know, I think the average is seven in 14 years, actually, if you include your temporary spell, for which we're profoundly grateful, by the way.
Thank you very much. So,
I mean,
not everybody is, but anyway.
I think, you know, I'll answer the question directly, but let me just give you an aside. I don't come in with a pedigree in football. You did kindly point out I know a little bit about football. Clearly not the team I support, but I've had some other experience. So I get told probably once a week, Martin, it's different in football. You know, football's different. And there are differences to it, but I've spent my whole life working in industry saying, well, this industry is different from that industry. Thriving organisations normally have similar characteristics. So people, you know, there is a commonality of purpose. People know what they're about. They understand what the ambition of the organisation is. And then typically as well, you have... you don't have the same person having to deliver it there for 15 years, but you have a succession program where if new people come in, they want the same thing. So I think the criticism factually is fair because it's been a lot, but I think it's been amplified by the fact that there probably hasn't been seen to be a unity of strategy or purpose to make that work. And I think that's a challenge, you know, for us. But I think, you know, if you start with all agreeing within the FA, but in the wider game, the leagues, what are the few things we're trying to go and do? Actually, the ambition becomes more important than the people delivering it. The other point, I'd say the FA is a little bit different from most other national associations. We're bigger. We make more money. We run Wembley. We run St. George's Park. It's a more complicated organism. And that's perhaps had its challenges too.
I want to come to that, but just thinking about the leadership still for a moment. You have a chairman, Greg Dyke,
yep,
who is an extrovert figure, well known certainly in the British public. And yet again, I don't think it's widely recognised that he's got to retire in, what is it, 18 months' time or so.
Yep.
So the revolving door goes round again. Do you think this people have to, in the FA, finish at 70. However well-meaning, I was around when it was introduced, for goodness sake. And it was, because certain people never seem to die at all, despite what you said earlier. Do you think that's a good thing in this generation?
Well, I think the FA is facing the demographic issue just like every other organisation, to be honest. So, you know, the median age of the population, so typically 50% of Brits are 54 and under. So we're an ageing population. And at 70, you're not definitely old anymore. So I think having age-based rules is probably less applicable today, and you should be looking at merit, not age. So I think that's the case. But I'd rather sort of answer your question, if I could, by expanding it slightly, which is there is an opportunity which we plan to seize in the FA, which is to say, well, let's clear up what are the various rules. So, you know, we're looking right now, we're saying in FIFA, it's really important to have term limits. So it's not healthy to have a Sepp Blatter on his fifth term because, you know, it just leads to possibly lazy practices if you're being generous. It's not healthy. Most successful organisations, whether you start off with, the US presidency to whatever else, go for term limits. So we need to look at the whole association and look at what we think the right rules are and not, in my view, not limit people who just happen to be 70 but could have all their faculties working, have tons of energy and base things more on merit, but have some more prescribed checks and balances based on other rules. And it's a bit of it's a bit unclear right now. So the FA Council have different rules to the board, etc. So I think it's an opportunity to clear up.
But you see, you're sitting here and saying something that some of us think is perfectly logical. And then you go over to something called FIFA, and there's 209 countries and 208 more of you. And the rest of the world has only quite recently voted against limiting terms and these sort of limits. So we're one country in this great world game.
Well, to be fair, the FIFA reform hasn't been voted down by FIFA delegates.
Yeah,
it's been stuck in a subcommittee of ethics, brilliantly managed by Blatter, so it's never come up. So I don't think that reform has been put to people, but we know de facto FIFA will reform and it has to. So the pressure has built. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, and that will happen. So I don't think you're going to get.
So you're more optimistic about FIFA going forward than some people, perhaps?
Much more. It's going to be much, much better because of the crisis that it's faced. I mean, the challenge of FIFA is we all have a. If you're British, it's very easy to be moralistic. We live on an island, we can take very moralistic views about foreign policy of country X, Y, or Z. I was at the FIFA convention my second week in the job, and you sit in alphabetical order. And so to my right was Equatorial New Guinea. So I became their best friends by the end of the conference. Yep. And when you talking to them, so why are you such a big supporter of Blatter? And the guy there was very acute. He said, well, look, you've been a CEO. He said, if you'd sort of shown that you doubled revenues in 5 years, if you transformed places where you'd taken your showpiece tournament, that you'd innovated and taken it to countries it'd never been to, and you'd broken the old order, you might actually be seen to be quite a sort of progressive guy. That's how we see Blatter. And by the way, the other thing that FIFA's done brilliantly under Blatter, it's a force for redistribution. So it's a great way of cycling money away from rich countries to poor countries to build facilities, to build football. The problem being that level of patronage that FIFA enjoy has allowed itself to be, I think, probably abused. And I've got to be careful about what I say, but clearly within some of the receiving countries, there's not an audit trail of where money's gone. So the conditions for corrupt practices are great. But
did you say that to your friend from Equatorial Guinea?
Equatorial Guinea, and he agrees.
Yeah.
Nobody wants corruption. But where we are now, thankfully, is that Blatter's resigned. The sponsors are all applying appropriate pressure on them, saying, look, by the way, if you take either the UK Bribery Act or the US Bribery Act, you are absolutely obliged as a corporation to make sure that you're not giving money to any other third party that might be engaged in corrupt activity. So the pressure to reform is there, and it's going to happen, and all of the candidates to varying degrees want to do it. But more importantly, there is a process that's separate to the candidates running for FIFA, which will bring in much more standard types of corporate governance that you'd expect from a big corporation. Will it ever be perfect? Nothing's ever perfect. Will it be different? Absolutely.
Is your chairman's publicly stated ambition of England winning a World Cup, the World Cup of Qatar in 2022, in the winter, as we now know, is that realistic?
It is realistic. I mean, let me step back. I mean, any good organisation, whether you're in football or business or public service, every organisation needs an ambition against which to rally. So, you know, the proverbial one of JFK in his acceptance speech in 63 saying, by the end of the decade, there will be a man on the moon, you know, was a great rallying cry within the US to develop a NASA space system, etc. So every, you know, if you don't have ambition, any road looks the same.